Welcome to the Nickel Plate Nordic podcast. In this unique podcast, everything you hear is, including the voices, is computer generated. We use the latest AI tools to bring you insights straight from published scientific research. Each episode is analyzed and summarized to make complex information easier to understand and more accessible. Today's episode examines how our energy systems work in cross-country skiing. Want to read the original study? Visit our website at nickelplatenordic.org for direct links to the source and more details. Now let's glide into the conversation.
Welcome to another deep dive. Today, we're strapping on our skis and hitting the slopes, well, metaphorically, of course, to explore the fascinating world of energy systems in competitive cross-country skiing.
Yeah.
We've got some excerpts from a scientific review article.
Okay.
It's called Energy System Contribution During Competitive Cross-Country Skiing.
Interesting.
Published in the European Journal of Applied Physiology. Get ready to discover how this incredible sport pushes the limits of human endurance.
It's a sport that truly demands a remarkable interplay of aerobic and anaerobic energy systems.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Let's kick things off with a little history lesson. Think about the Vasiloppet, that legendary 90-kilometer cross-country ski race.
Okay.
Back in the day, winning times were over 7 hours. These days, elite skiers are finishing in under 4.
Really?
That's cutting the race time nearly in half.
What's fascinating is that this dramatic decrease in race time reflects a substantial increase in average race speed, about 10% in distance races and even more in sprints. This evolution has completely reshaped the physiological, technical, and tactical demands on these athletes.
Okay, I'm already starting to see how demanding this sport is, but how does speed tie into energy systems?
Well, to understand speed in endurance sports like cross-country skiing, we need to consider three key factors: metabolic energy turnover, economy of locomotion, and the balance between them. Metabolic energy turnover is essentially how efficiently your body converts fuel into energy. Think of it as your engine's horsepower.
Okay, got it. Powerful engine, check. What about that second factor, economy of locomotion?
Economy of locomotion is all about how much energy it costs to move your body forward. Think of it as your car's fuel efficiency.
Okay.
The lower the energy cost, the more economical your movement.
Makes sense. So you need a powerful engine and good fuel efficiency to achieve high speeds. But there's more to it, right? You mentioned this balance between the two.
Exactly. It's not enough to simply have a powerful engine or be super fuel efficient. It's about finding that sweet spot where those two factors work together in perfect harmony.
That's interesting. I'm starting to see how complex this all is.
Yeah.
Now, the article also mentions this idea of a gearing system in cross-country skiing. Can you explain that a little more?
Imagine you're cycling and you encounter a steep hill. You'll probably shift to a lower gear to get more power, right? Well, cross-country skiing is similar. Skiers use different techniques, kind of like shifting gears depending on the terrain and the speed they need.
Okay.
For example, picture a skier battling their way up a steep incline. They might use the herringbone technique, spreading their skis out in a V shape and using short, powerful strides for maximum traction.
Okay, I can picture that. It looks exhausting.
It definitely is. Now imagine that same skier gliding effortlessly on flat terrain. They'll likely switch to the V2 skate technique with long, elegant strides that maximize speed and efficiency. The article has some cool illustrations, figures 2A and 2B, that show these techniques in action.
Ah, so it's all about adapting to the terrain and choosing the most efficient technique for the situation.
Exactly. And this constant adaptation adds another layer of complexity to the energy demands of cross-country skiing.
Right. You're not just relying on one type of movement. You're constantly adjusting based on the terrain. Here's something I found surprising. The article mentions that even in long-distance races, cross-country skiing relies heavily on anaerobic energy. I always thought endurance sports were all about aerobic fitness.
That's a common misconception. Most people think of endurance sports as slow and steady, fueled solely by aerobic metabolism. But cross-country skiing throws a wrench in that assumption.
So why is that?
Well, the intermittent nature of the sport plays a key role. Think about it. You've got uphill sections that demand intense bursts of power, followed by flat sections and even downhills where you can recover.
Okay.
Take a look at figure 3 from the article. It shows a typical race profile with those varying terrains.
Got it. So you're using bursts of anaerobic energy for those tough uphill pushes, then catching your breath on the downhill. So it's like a constant cycle of pushing and recovering.
Precisely. And studies using wearable sensors, you know, those cool gadgets that track all sorts of physiological data, have revealed something remarkable. Elite skiers frequently operate above their VO2 peak, particularly during those demanding uphill stretches.
Wow.
Figure 4 in the article actually shows this.
Whoa, hold on. You're saying they're exceeding their maximum rate of oxygen consumption?
Yes. Their bodies are working so hard that they're tapping into their anaerobic energy systems even more than we initially thought.
That's incredible. So it's not just about having a huge aerobic engine. These athletes also need incredible anaerobic capacity.
Exactly. And that leads us to a very important point. Peak aerobic power, or VO2 peak, is still crucial in both sprint and distance skiing. In fact, elite cross-country skiers boast some of the highest VO2 max values ever recorded in endurance athletes.
Higher than marathon runners, really.
You bet. We're talking values exceeding 70 milliliters per kilogram per minute in women and 80 in men.
Wow.
To put that in perspective, most elite marathon runners have VO2 max values in the high 60s to mid 70s.
Wow. Okay, now I'm really impressed. It makes sense, though, given how much ground they cover and the varying terrain they tackle. I'm guessing the specific technique they use also impacts their VO2 peak.
Absolutely. The different techniques engage the upper and lower body muscles to varying degrees, which can lead to variations in VO2 peak. For example, research has consistently shown that VO2 peak is generally higher in diagonal stride compared to double poling or skating.
Interesting. The article mentions an inverted U-shaped curve to explain this. Could you break that down for me?
Sure. Imagine a graph where the x-axis represents the percentage of work done by the arms, and the axis represents the overall VO2 peak. As the arm contribution increases, you initially see a rise in VO2 peak.
Okay.
This makes sense because you're engaging more muscles. But there's a tipping point. Once the arms are doing more than about 30% of the work, the overall VO2 peak actually starts to decline.
So too much arm work actually lowers peak aerobic power. Why is that?
That's the million-dollar question. Research, like the study by Calbay et al. In 2005, suggests it boils down to physiological differences between arm and leg muscles. Even with intense upper body training, the arms, even in elite skiers, just can't extract oxygen as efficiently as the legs. They have a lower oxidative capacity. It's a fascinating area of research.
It really is. So even though they train their upper bodies like crazy, there seems to be a limit to how much oxygen their arm muscles can utilize.
Exactly. And despite this extensive upper body training, the VO2 peak in double poling, a technique that relies heavily on arm power, consistently lags behind that of running.
Wait, so they're using their arms a lot, but the oxygen uptake isn't as high as when they're running? That seems counterintuitive.
It is a bit of a head scratcher. And it leads us to a really interesting question. Why? Well, it turns out that recent findings suggest the upper body muscles in skiers might have similar adaptive potential to the legs. There are studies, like those by Ortenblad et al. In 2018 and Terzies et al. In 2006, that suggest there might be factors beyond muscle oxidative capacity at play here.
So there's more to the story than just how well the muscles use oxygen.
Absolutely. It's a complex interplay of factors, and scientists are still working to unravel the full picture. It's a puzzle with many pieces.
Well, this has been incredibly insightful. Before we move on to anaerobic capacity, let's take a moment to recap what we've learned so far.
Good idea. We've seen how cross-country skiing has evolved dramatically over the past century, leading to much faster race times and highlighting the crucial roles of both aerobic and anaerobic energy systems.
Right. We've also touched on the fascinating concept of a gearing system, where skiers use different techniques based on terrain and speed, kind of like shifting gears on a bike.
And we've discovered that VO2 peak plays a critical role, but the upper body's ability to utilize oxygen despite rigorous training appears to have a ceiling. There's clearly more to uncover.
Absolutely. Now, let's shift gears, so to speak, and delve into the world of anaerobic capacity. Just how important is it in separating sprint skiers from distance skiers?
Anaerobic capacity is a key differentiator. One way to measure it is by looking at the maximal accumulated oxygen deficit, which essentially tells us how much energy an athlete can produce without relying on oxygen.
Okay, so it's a measure of how much they can push their bodies without needing oxygen. What have studies shown about this in cross-country skiers?
Studies have shown that elite sprint skiers, particularly males, have a significantly higher anaerobic capacity than distance skiers. This makes sense, as they need that extra burst of power for those short, intense races.
So for those quick bursts of speed needed in a sprint, anaerobic capacity is king. That makes sense. But the article also mentions an interesting sex difference.
Yes. The difference in anaerobic capacity between men and women is even more pronounced than the differences we see in VO2 max or oxygen cost.
Wow, that's fascinating. Any theories on why that might be?
It could be linked to the greater reliance on upper body strength in techniques like V2 skating and double poling. Since men tend to have a greater upper body muscle mass, this could contribute to the difference.
So it's not just about leg power. The upper body plays a significant role too, especially in those techniques.
Exactly. And this brings us to another intriguing aspect of cross-country skiing, pacing strategies. Have you ever heard of positive and variable pacing?
I have not. Can you enlighten me?
Of course. Positive pacing, in simple terms, means slowing down over time.
Okay.
Elite steers actually reduce their speed across laps, even in sprints. This contrasts with a negative pacing strategy, where you start slow and speed up towards the end.
Huh. That's interesting. You'd think they'd want to maintain a consistent speed, wouldn't you?
You might think so, but there are strategic reasons for slowing down. Remember, these races can be incredibly grueling, and they need to conserve energy to make it to the finish line. Now, within each lap, they also use variable pacing, adjusting their energy output based on the terrain and the speed they need.
Okay, so they're not just slowing down overall, they're also strategically adjusting their speed within each lap. This is where it gets really interesting.
It definitely adds a layer of complexity. Research suggests that skiers actually use higher power outputs and intensities during uphill sections compared to flat sections. There are a few reasons for this.
Okay, lay them on me. Why would they push harder going uphill?
Well, first, at slower speeds, like going uphill, there's less energy lost to air resistance. Second, the total energy turnover available during double poling, which is often used on flatter terrain, might be lower compared to diagonal stride, a technique often used uphill.
So it's like shifting to a lower gear on a bike for those tough climbs. You need more power to overcome the incline.
A perfect analogy. But there's a third factor that's particularly fascinating. At very high speeds, there are biomechanical limitations. Specifically, the short pull contact times restrict power output. You can actually see this in Figure 5 from the article.
So even if they wanted to go all out on flat sections, their bodies might not be able to generate enough power due to those limitations.
That's precisely it. It's a fascinating interplay between physiology and biomechanics.
Mind-blowing. Before we move on, I'm curious about something. The article mentioned some challenges in accurately measuring anaerobic capacity in cross-country skiing. Why is that so tricky?
Well, the existing methodologies have limitations. Even the maximal accumulated oxygen deficit method, which is commonly used, isn't perfect.
So it's not as simple as just hooking someone up to a machine and getting a number. What makes it so challenging in this specific sport?
When you factor in the unique demands of cross-country skiing, with all the different techniques, speeds, inclines, and individual variations in muscle use designing tests that accurately capture anaerobic capacity, becomes really challenging.
So there's still work to be done to refine those measurement tools.
Absolutely. It's a fascinating area of ongoing research.
Well, this deep dive has already been a real eye-opener. I had no idea cross-country skiing was so complex and demanding.
It's a sport that pushes the limits of human physiology and athleticism in truly remarkable ways, and we've only just scratched the surface.
It really is. I'm starting to understand why those skiers have such incredible physiques. It's not just about endurance. It's about power, agility, and strategy.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've established that cross-country skiing demands a lot from both the aerobic and anaerobic systems. What else can you tell me about these energy systems?
Well, it's important to remember that these two systems don't work in isolation. They're constantly interacting, and the balance between them shifts depending on the demands of the race.
So it's like a dance between these two systems, with one taking the lead and then the other, depending on the terrain and intensity.
A perfect analogy. And we've seen that this interplay is incredibly complex, influenced by everything from the specific technique being used to the athlete's sex.
It's mind-boggling to think about how these skiers are essentially pushing their bodies to the limit time and time again throughout a race. And remember those incredibly high VO2 max values we talked about. Well, that's just one piece of the puzzle. Elite cross-country skiers also demonstrate incredible efficiency in their movements. They've honed their technique to minimize energy waste, allowing them to maintain those high speeds for extended periods.
It's true. They make it look effortless, but there's so much going on beneath the surface. It's a testament to their dedication and years of training.
Okay, let's circle back to something we touched on earlier, pacing strategies. You mentioned that elite skiers use both positive pacing, slowing down over time, and variable pacing, adjusting speed within laps based on terrain. What can you tell me about these strategies?
Well, positive pacing is all about conserving energy for the long haul. By gradually reducing their speed across laps, they avoid burning out too early in the race. It's a smart strategy, especially in those grueling distance events.
Right. You don't want to go out too hard and hit the wall halfway through. So how does variable pacing fit into this?
Variable pacing comes into play within each lap. Skiers will strategically adjust their speed based on the terrain. Remember how we talked about higher power outputs and intensities going uphill?
Yeah, they're basically shifting to a lower gear to conquer those climbs. Then they dial it back on the flats and downhills to recover.
Exactly. It's all about maximizing efficiency and energy conservation. Now, one of the things that fascinates me about pacing is the role of biomechanics. We talked about how at high speeds, the short pole contact times can limit power output. So even if they wanted to go all out on those flat sections, their bodies might not be able to keep up.
Right. Their poles are only in contact with the ground for a split second, so they can only generate so much force. It's like trying to sprint with your feet barely touching the ground. But if they slowed down a bit, they could extend that contact time and generate more power, right?
Precisely. It's a perfect example of how biomechanics can influence pacing strategies.
It's incredible how much science and strategy goes into this sport. You've really given me a whole new appreciation for cross-country skiing.
It's been my pleasure, but I think it's important to acknowledge that we still have a lot to learn about the energy systems involved in cross-country skiing. This is an area of ongoing research, and new discoveries are being made all the time.
That's exciting. What are some of the big unanswered questions that scientists are grappling with?
Well, for one, we still don't have perfect tools for measuring anaerobic capacity in this sport. The existing methods have limitations, and the unique demands of cross-country skiing make it really difficult to design tests that accurately capture this crucial aspect of performance. There's definitely a need for more research in this area.
So we've got these amazing athletes pushing the limits of human performance, but we're still refining our ability to measure just how incredible they are.
Exactly. And that brings us to another fascinating avenue of research, the quest for the optimal pacing strategy. We know that elite skiers use a combination of positive and variable pacing, but there's still so much to learn about how to fine-tune these strategies for peak performance.
So if researchers could crack the code of pacing, could these skiers potentially become even faster?
That's the million-dollar question. Imagine if we could develop algorithms that take into account all the variables, an athlete's physiology, the specific course, weather conditions, even the competition, and spit out a personalized pacing plan. It could revolutionize the sport. But even without those fancy algorithms, it's clear that pacing is a critical element of success in cross-country skiing.
Absolutely. And it highlights the importance of not just physical strength and endurance, but also tactical intelligence and the ability to adapt to ever-changing conditions on the course.
It's the perfect blend of physical and mental prowess.
Okay, I want to circle back to one more thing before we wrap up. We talked about how, despite extensive upper body training, there seems to be a limit to how much oxygen those arm muscles can utilize. What are some of the current theories about why that is?
Well, remember how we discussed that VO2 peak in double poling, which relies heavily on arm power, consistently falls short of VO2 peak in running? It's a real head scratcher, and scientists have proposed several theories to explain it.
Okay, fill me in. What are some of the leading contenders?
One theory focuses on the cardiovascular system. Some scientists believe there might be limitations in the heart and blood vessels' ability to deliver oxygen to the upper body muscles at those high intensities.
Interesting. So it's not just about the muscles themselves, but also about how efficiently the heart and blood vessels can supply them with oxygen. What other theories are out there?
Another line of thinking centers on the nervous system. Some researchers suggest there might be differences in the nervous system's control of muscle activation between the upper and lower body. Think about it. We use our legs for locomotion all the time, but our arms are typically used for more fine motor tasks. It's possible that this difference in neural control could play a role in the discrepancy we see in VO2 peak.
Fascinating. So we've got theories about the cardiovascular system, the nervous system, and even the inherent differences between arm and leg muscles. It sounds like there's still a lot we don't know.
Exactly. And this ongoing research highlights just how complex and adaptable the human body is, especially when pushed to its limits.
Okay, I think it's time for a final recap. What are the key takeaways about the unique energy system demands of cross-country skiing?
First and foremost, cross-country skiing is a truly remarkable sport that demands incredible athleticism. It requires a delicate balance of aerobic and anaerobic energy systems, with those intense uphill bursts requiring significant anaerobic contributions, even in distance events.
Right. We've learned that pacing strategies are crucial for optimizing performance, and elite skiers use a combination of positive and variable pacing to conserve energy and conquer those challenging courses.
And we've explored the fascinating phenomenon of the upper body's seemingly limited ability to utilize oxygen, even with rigorous training. It's a mystery that continues to intrigue scientists and reminds us of the complexity and wonder of the human body.
It's amazing how much we're still learning about the science of human performance, especially in a sport as demanding as cross-country skiing.
There's always more to discover. And as technology advances, like those wearable sensors we talked about, we'll gain even deeper insights into how these athletes push their bodies to the absolute limit.
I can't wait to see what the future holds for this incredible sport. But before we let our listener go, I have one final question. We've talked about all these incredible adaptations in elite skiers, their VO2 max, their technique, their pacing strategies. But is there a limit? How much faster can they realistically get?
That's a great question. And honestly, it's tough to say. We might be approaching the limits of human physiology in some areas, but there's always room for improvement in technique and strategy.
So even if we hit a biological ceiling, there's still potential to shave off precious seconds through better training methods and refinements in pacing.
Absolutely. And as technology continues to evolve, we might even see new equipment and training tools that push those boundaries even further. Imagine custom-designed skis that perfectly match an athlete's biomechanics, or training programs that use artificial intelligence to optimize pacing strategies. The possibilities are endless.
Wow. It's incredible to think about the potential for innovation in this sport. It makes me want to strap on some skis and hit the slopes myself. Well, maybe not quite yet. I think I'll stick to admiring these incredible athletes from the comfort of my couch.
I think that's a wise choice. Cross-country skiing is definitely not for the faint of heart.
Well, on that note, we'll wrap up this deep dive into the fascinating world of energy systems in competitive cross-country skiing. We hope you've enjoyed the journey as much as we have.
It's been a pleasure sharing these insights with you. And remember, even if you never plan to tackle a cross-country ski race yourself, you can still appreciate the incredible feats of human endurance and the science behind it all.
Absolutely. Until next time, keep exploring, keep learning, and keep pushing your own limits, whatever they may be.